Oh, I didn't know we now live in the future.
Was thinking about this today. Do you feel,
Here we go.
how arrogant do you feel trying to do a podcast?
I in no way, shape, or form.
Hi, Milo.
We should probably mention that. Today we have
A special guest.
daycare and a mini co-host as well. My son Milo is with us today.
Would you ever do those? It's almost like Uber for babysitting. Like, were you, it's like a
I
service.
don't know what that is. Oh, you're talking about that somebody will come out to the house?
Yeah, like it's like.
We've looked into like multiple times. I don't know, it's literally it's like babysitter.com. I don't know. So, we looked
Right,
into a
some
couple of
craziness.
a couple different services. And we've never actually hired one. Like we went through like a couple scenarios and honestly, mostly it came down to money. And we're like, look, we can just reschedule this until we have one of our parents available, right now, to not spend the hundreds of dollars it's going to cost to have one for the evening.
We did it once in Miami.
Oof. Yeah.
The woman was crazy nice, and it's got reviews and stuff like that, and the reviews were good. But I remember it being crazy expensive.
It's
It,
and they have like the rate, which is dependent upon like their experience and their
right,
capabilities. Are they
right,
CPR certified and all sorts of stuff?
right. And
Yes.
you don't want to go cheap on
Right. Not worth it. Yeah. Let me. This is where I'm going to cut some corners.
75 an hour or $10 an hour? What's the difference? Well, life and death. All right, what you got for today?
You are. Hi, sir. Yes, sir.
Are we? Can you just look up the thing to see?
I can't right now. Right now I'm filming. I'm working with Uncle Rick. So can you,
This is work.
if you can't figure it out, then maybe we switch over to watching a movie or a show for now.
No,
Okay.
thanks.
Okay, you can keep playing if you'd like. Are you watching the lobby? By the way, are you
Yeah,
watching the lobby?
yes, it pops up and it says, "Hey, you got,
Okay,
hey,
cool. Well, I've
you
never
don't
done
tell
it,
me how to
so
do
I
my
don't know.
job."
Well.
So today we're going to have on Mac Rogers. So Mac is uber successful. Where I know him from is that he's married to your sister.
My brother-in-law.
And he is a playwright, has successful podcasts, but not in the podcast like we do, where it's talking back and forth, talking to guests. He does stories. So basically, think play, old time radio is kind of how it is, but he's taking it to that next level. Him and his team has taken it like 15 levels up. So last Christmas, I listened to the Jordan Peele executive produced Quiet Part Loud, which they had billboards all over New York City and stuff. And so I'm definitely want to talk to him about that. But that was groundbreaking in the sense to me of how you can make something so entertaining, so visual on a audio platform, like spoken word platform. When we say spoken word, I mean it is produced. It is like an action movie at times. Really, really well done. So I'm excited to talk to him about that.
Yeah, I love Mac. Everybody loves
Everyone
Mac.
loves Mac.
Everybody loves Mac.
Oh, here he is. You ready?
Ebb and flow, here we go.
Ah, there he is.
I'm so much more brightly lit than you all are. How are you? Good morning. Good morning. How are y'all doing?
Morning.
Mac, before, okay, so I started to lay a little bit of the groundwork. You're my brother-in-law, so we're trying to let people know like the connection here, right? You're my brother-in-law. You married my oldest sister,
Okay.
Sandy.
Ah,
So,
Sandy. She's the
yep,
best.
and Sandy is the best. And so right off the bat, beyond you being my brother-in-law, the real reason that we have you on here is to talk about some of your success associated with being a playwright and your podcast and all sorts of stuff, which is quite advantageous for us because we know nothing about podcasts. And so, who
Oh,
better to.
it's brutal. It's just.
When people think of a podcast, way more often they think of what you all are doing than what I do. They really think of like a couple of funny guys like saying funny stuff.
Yeah, as soon as we get those guys on here, we'll have some comedy.
All you need is a couple of funny guys.
So wait, to that point, Mac, that is one of the things I want to ask. When how do you define like the category of podcast that you make? How, what's the differentiation between like that versus what this is?
Okay. Well, I mean, this is something that's been a subject of, because you know, all of us on social media, we follow and are followed by people with similar interests. So you end up kind of getting involved in like a siloed conversation about a specialized subject. In the case of what I do, there's just been endless fights about what the exact right proper term is. The two that sort of seem to have floated to the top are audio drama and scripted podcast or fiction podcast. See, I was promising you two, and there's so much dispute about it. It's like all three. Decades ago, what I do would very straightforwardly have been called a radio drama. Because yeah, that was the dominant form of mass media before TV came along. A lot of people have seen the movie A Christmas Story, which is famous for, you know, the tongue stuck at the pole, the other stuff, you'll shoot your eye out. But one of the slightly less famous sequences in it involves the family, the kid yelling at his family to get home in time because he wants to listen to the latest installment of some sort of cheesy adventure story that he always listens to on the radio. And we're all old enough to remember racing home because to see an episode of a show that we loved, because there would never be another chance if we didn't get there in time. Yeah, the G.I. Joe cartoon when I was growing up, Doctor Who. Yeah, so radio drama, everybody would have just agreed radio drama. With podcasts, it's really weird because it's like, you know, it's audio drama because it's not, strictly speaking, like people are listening to the radio. For a long time, scripted podcast was very popular, but then a lot of people who do, you know, journalistic research, true crime, historical podcast, they would say, well, you know, we do actually have a script for our shows. Our shows aren't fiction, but we assemble the various footage, voiceover material, citations, whatever it is, and it becomes a scripted thing in the process. So the scripted, a scripted podcast might not necessarily refer to fiction. So fiction podcast versus audio drama kind of, I guess, are the two big terms sort of warring it out. One will eventually become the victor over time just by attrition.
Can we take a step back? How did you get into what, obviously it was playwriting first, right? Like, how did you get into that?
Yeah.
What have you done? And then how did that lead to podcasting?
Well, and so give us like the 2 minute version, right? And then we're just going to ask a zillion questions along the way.
Yeah. By the way, we're really good at interrupting while you're talking. So
gotcha.
We don't let you finish your thought.
No, with me, you have to. I'm so bad about rambling. Okay, so 2 minute version is I got into playwriting super young, elementary school, middle school. I was doing little tiny plays in my church. I started writing super long epic plays in college. I went into New York, formed a theater company with some friends. We didn't catch on for a very long time. We only started catching on when I started writing science fiction plays. Writing science fiction plays is what got me the end to doing my first fiction podcast, The Message, because I'd had an acclaimed fiction play on stage. And then that sort of led to all of the audio drama fiction podcasts that I've been doing over the course of my career the last 5 or 6 years.
That was impressive.
Wow. I can't believe how fast I did that.
What have you thought about writing for movies or television?
I've been trying a few things to try to like angle my way into one or two of those over the past several years. I mean, a big part of why me and my theater colleagues kind of switched our focus from theater to podcasts was because, much to my surprise, I wrote two podcasts purely as a writer for hire, no IP ownership. I wrote two podcasts, and to my shock, I found out later on that both of those podcasts were optioned by big Hollywood companies. They didn't do anything with them, like what happens with, I think, the majority of options, of course, is that no one had an immediate idea what to do with them, so they ended up just going down some, you know, someone's big treasure hoard of IP. But that was my first inkling. This is 2015, 2016. It was like, so Hollywood is now treating fiction podcasts as a source of, to develop film and television from. I remember the way one person put it to me was, fiction podcasts are the new comic books.
For sure.
Because it's kind of like a way of doing a dry run of something. And increasingly, there's a lot of speculative fiction podcasts that are made and seeing how people react to it. So the biggest angle I've been working to try to get into television film is to is by having one of my podcast options. This has happened now. I've twice had podcasts optioned by Hollywood companies, and in both cases, they were not able to find a streamer or a network to buy it.
Since recording this interview, Mac wrote the movie First Time Caller, now streaming on Amazon Prime.
One item I want to throw in real quick is we keep referencing IP as an intellectual property. So someone that may not.
Right.
So,
if they're listening to this, they know what IP is.
Listen, your mom is might be listening to this and she would not.
She doesn't know what a podcast is. So
anyway, intellectual property associated with those are your ideas and then whether or not you own those ideas. Right. Or you've had.
We started talking about this at Christmas, and then we were so rudely pulled away. I don't even remember why we were pulled away. I think your dad kicked us out, Eric.
Family gift exchange or something, yeah.
I am such a fan of Quiet Part Loud. I thought that was brilliant. I think, I listened to it. I binged it like nonstop while on the drive up, and while I'm listening to the kids who come and ask me questions, I'm like, shut up, I'm listening to my friend's podcast. So can you talk to me about how did that come about?
This would have been by late 2019 when the conversation started. By then, I had managed to put together a pretty solid reputation. I'd written The Message and Life After for Panoply, and both of those were big hits for Panoply. And then I kind of went out with my theater colleagues as I want to start creating podcasts that I own. But at the same time, I didn't give up my other job of being just a for hire writer of audio dramas. But we created a podcast in 2017 called Steal the Stars, a science fiction heist story that also did really well. So by then I'd had a bunch of well-known fiction podcasts to my name. So that I was like now a credible figure in terms of somebody you might hire for one of these things. But over the years that I've been making plays, indie theater, there was a wonderful playwright and actor that I'd known all the time named Clay McLeod Chapman. Clay and he wrote these wonderful one person plays, and he and I had known each other for decades, and he had had a long standing relationship with Monkey Paw Productions, which is Jordan Peele's production company. They were talking to him about writing a fiction podcast for them. And there was a brief period where it looked like he couldn't do it, that various other conflicts may be in the way. And he said, but I know one of my colleagues from theater has a reputation now writing fiction podcasts. Let me introduce you to him. Maybe he could write it for you instead. Then at the last moment, Clay's schedule opened up, and what they decided to do was hire the two of us to co-write it, which was super fun because he and I had been... we'd known each other. We've been good friends. We've been good co-artists in the same theater scene for decades. But this was our very first time working together in this way. And for what we knew was going to be a really high profile project. And so it basically just came about through just an extremely longstanding theater connection, which is the weirdest thing.
Did they have a shell of an idea, and whose idea was it? And then they brought it to you and you guys expanded it? Because how many episodes is it? It's like 12 episodes or something.
12. Yeah. You know, and that's always an interesting creative challenge, is because companies that are selling that, you know, they're monetizing their podcast by selling ads. They're obviously going to want more episodes. I'm always a little bit leery. You know, once you start going north of 10, there's a real danger of the story sagging in the middle. But I understand, you know, that's the business. On Steal the Stars, we had I had a plan for 10 episodes. The company that co-produced and put up all the money for it, they wanted 16. I was like, oh my God, I finally negotiated them down to 14 and figured out a way of doing it.
God, it's so different in our world.
Yeah.
We sell our show and we get paid by how many episodes we do. So we're trying to expand it. Even if we think it's going to sag, I got kids that, you know, need to go to college. So story to me doesn't matter. It's all about that bank. but you're saying like you're a true artist. So you're like, it's going to sag.
Well, no, I have definitely made numerous compromises for money. I will definitely admit that. But, so, okay, in terms of, like, your question about what when they came to us, the idea was, the story was about a supernatural monster that sort of preys on marginalized people during periods of intense social prejudice of some sort. And they knew that they wanted the first season to be about this monster preying on Muslim Americans in the wake of 9/11. They knew they had that much, and we didn't change that idea. We ran with that idea. But the one thing that Clay and I did have a big hand in changing was that their initial concept was that this documentary about this monster was going to be observed from the point of view of an outsider. I think they had a Scandinavian reporter. Their original idea was that it would be someone on the outside of American culture, sort of, you know, giving it that outside eye. And Clay and I talked about it, and we were kind of excited about the idea of having an investigator who would become deeply enmeshed in the story, who would be right at the heart of it, and would be right at the heart of kind of the cross currents and undercurrents of American culture that this story was exploring. So we came with the idea of a guy of like an Alex Jones type guy, a media personality who was really big on radio, had gotten disgraced, lost his radio job. And we eventually came up with the idea of his disgrace being exactly connected with the events of the story. And then later he tries to come back when podcasts come along. We wanted to take advantage of the idea that this new media would reopen the possibility of this guy coming back. He doesn't need a gatekeeper anymore. He doesn't need a big radio network to give him permission, a big fancy studio, he could just do it himself, and as a way of like getting his career back, he starts a podcast. And so the biggest change that Clay and I brought to the table was changing the nature of the protagonist.
But that's the biggest thing. Like, to me, that's what kind of made this thing brilliant was the thing that you've done is you took this bad guy, like what he does in there in the beginning is bad, mm-hmm. and you make him the main character, but then mm-hmm. you bring in like the daughter to show that some of it's an act, but he does believe some of it, and some of it's like just mm-hmm. overamplification, which you know is happening with people like Alex Jones or even in the news, they overamplify it.
Right.
So when you were pitching that idea of basically making a villain be the main character, was there pushback? Was there mm-hmm. like, oh, that's interesting?
They were on board with it right away, which is a very unique experience for me, I should say, because every other job I've had for like an outside company, there's always a push to make the main character more likable. Even if the main character is a hero who has some unlikable qualities,
right?
Everyone gets so nervous. Nowadays, I have a hard time writing a character who's even like a house type character, like a house MD type character, where like they're the hero of the story, they're brilliant, they're the one person who can save the day, but they're like super prickly to the people around them. I found that like executives I talk to, like they're like, well, couldn't he also be nicer? I'm like, is there supposed to be anything wrong with this guy? But in that particular case, the Monkey Paw people were fearless about it. They were like, you know, let's go all out with making this guy hateful. And they were totally on board with, like, even though he gets super humbled in the story by disgrace and then like all of the turmoil and trouble that he goes through with the monster, which is called the blank. Even then he doesn't become a nice guy in the wake of all that. And indeed gets drawn into a Faustian bargain, with the monster. And, so they were surprisingly I've got to give a lot of props to the Monkey Paw executives. They totally supported us in that choice, and they never ever asked us to soften the character.
Have you ever had as much promotion behind a podcast as this latest one? Because I remember this is you in Times Square with a picture behind you.
I never experienced anything like Quiet Part Loud, where Eric, as you mentioned earlier, they did a lot of huge promotion, especially like the week it came out. They for about 2 weeks they had they purchased time on one of those rotating digital Times Square billboards and then a rotating digital Madison Square Garden one. So Clay and I, the morning that dropped, we like rode into the city. We went to Times Square. It was tricky because it was like rotating through ads for a couple of different things, and if we didn't get the picture exactly right, we had to wait for them to go through some others, you know, like I think some kind of like instant macaroni or something before. So we're standing there trying to take the selfie we're looking at the screen behind us, like, okay, it's right after the Instant Macaroni. So as soon as the Instant Macaroni starts fading, then, like, put on your best smile, you know. So we did that, and then we went down to Madison Square Garden to do the other one, and that was a huge thrill. But also, Jordan Peele, who was really the public face. No one was like, oh, my God, the new Mac Rogers and Clay McLeod Chapman podcast came out.
I was.
That's right. You were, yeah, God bless you, yeah. But mainly it was like Jordan Peele was like the key, you know, like creative on it. So he went on The Daily Show. He did a ton of promo that week. And it was, so it was a promotional blitz like I had never experienced for anything that I was connected with. And then there was even a premiere in L.A. at the Spotify sort of compound campus, whatever you call it. They threw a big party. They had a thing where you could, like, take your picture with, like, this rippling signal effect on it to be kind of like cool. The story. And then they brought everyone into a big theater that had the Atmos sound. All know better than me. They gave us all branded Quiet Part Loud night masks to put on as we sat in the theater, and then they played an edit of three episodes in the Atmos surround sound. So we effectively had a theatrical premiere for a fiction podcast.
Were they showing anything in the theater?
No, they gave them masks.
Nothing on the screen.
Wow.
Yeah, they covered our eyes with these night. I still have it somewhere. That was my Quiet Part Loud branded night mask.
Yeah, like a sleep mask that covers up your eyes, right? Yeah.
The production on it is absolutely insane. And that's the first thing that you notice. And you guys got Christina Hendricks, right?
Right. Yeah. She played Allied Alice was the name of the character, that she was like a radio host from like the 1940s.
Oh, so good.
And so we had a lot of fun, like, sort of writing this, like, old school, like, 1940s, like, wisecracking dame. And we weren't necessarily thinking about casting when we were writing, but if we had been talking about it and they were like, who do you want? I probably would have said, well, obviously you want like a Christina Hendricks. You're not going to get Christina Hendricks. Come on, that's ridiculous. But that's definitely the vein of actor you should be looking for to play this part. But so when they told us who the casting was going to be, I was like, oh my God, you've got the platonic ideal actress to play this role. And when I listened to it, I was like, oh my God, it sounds exactly perfect. She has the exact perfect voice.
Mac, I want to go back. You made a reference to when finding some success when you started writing sci-fi. I've only ever known you writing sci-fi stuff, you know, early on. And so can you kind of talk about that journey, what got you there? And was the first shot out of the gate the Honeycomb trilogy?
There have been a few before that. I was a big Doctor Who dork when I was a little kid. We were PBS kids. I don't think my parents didn't forbid us from watching other channels, but I think they kind of didn't tell us there were other channels. We had to kind of like find out from the other kids at school. But we watched PBS, and you know, I got into Doctor Who from PBS, that got me into other science fiction. As I got older, I was always big into science fiction as a little kid, and I was big into theater as a little kid. I did a lot of children's theater shows, but I always sort of perceived those as two separate interests, because plays aren't about aliens and space and robots. Whatever plays are about, you know, they're either about like knights and swords or they're about torment. But you're never going to have an alien in a play. And then as I got sort of into my teenage and early 20s years, like the kinds of plays I was writing in high school, and then the kind of plays I kind of went nuts with in college, I kind of sort of shifted into this mentality that like plays are meant to be these incredibly autobiographical portraits where you lay yourself raw, 3-hour long plays about your own personal anguish, where there's a character on stage who's definitely you. maybe it's played by someone else, but it's an obvious stand in for you. And I did a bunch of those plays in college in this tiny black box theater, and where my entire audience was going to be artsy, solipsistic, you know, narcissistic undergrads who were like, oh yeah, a play should absolutely be a 3-hour long play about a narcissist who thinks his feelings are the most important thing in the world. I moved to New York and I did my first play with some friends of mine there that I acted in it and I wrote it. And it was 3 hours long and it was all about my emotions. Nobody came to see it. We a handful of our friends who happen to live in New York came to see it, but then when any strangers came and saw it, a lot of times they would just leave it intermission. You could see there, and I was in the play. There was a lot of direct address monologue in the play. You could see people's faces just fall when they realized what they'd walked into. You could see them going, "Oh God, this is a young guy's autobiographical play. I have no idea how intermission could be 2 hours from now. I have no idea when I'll be able to get out of here." I still to this day call that the best artistic and showbiz lesson I ever got. I didn't go to grad school for playwriting. I didn't need to go to grad school for playwriting because my grad school was looking directly in the eyes of the people I was boring. I started thinking, well, what do I like? I like sci-fi. I like horror. I like thrillers. I started trying to figure out, are there ways of telling those stories theatrically? That's what got me into writing more and more kind of genre-inflected stories. My first big one was a horror play called Hail Satan, about a guy who gets a new office job, discovers all of his colleagues belong to a Satan-worshipping cult. And then I did a play called Universal Robots, and that was one that really caught on with the downtown indie theater crowd, and it was very unapologetically science fiction play, but with some political overtones and with... And again, there was no obvious Mac analog on stage. There was no character on stage. It's like, oh, that's Mac, and this is all about Mac's emotions. It was a big adventure with like death and jokes and reversals and robots and stuff like that. It was like, oh, right. It's like the kind of thing that I would go and see. Of course, I would do a better job writing something that I find that's fun.
I just want to close kind of the piece that you... you just explained about some of your process and leading up to and switching over. Like, it felt like a very like defining time in your career, defining moment of having that, what you were saying, like that was the best education you could have ever received, right? Of seeing the faces and like being able to do that analysis that eventually like got you mentally to that point of like doing the stuff that you're passionate about and you love. That sounds very defining. I just wanted to point it out because that's what we're talking about here.
I could not have rigged it to have been a more profoundly humiliating experience because like once we started going, it's a 3 hour long play, right? There was an intermission middle, 3 hour long play. I would realize in the first 10 minutes that the audience was miserable and I still had the rest of the next 2 hours and 50 minutes to go. And we rented a theater for four. I don't know who we thought we were. We rented a theater for 4 weeks. We didn't know anybody in New York City. So the audience was like three people per show. So this ordeal dragged out for a month.
Defining moments don't have to be positive, for sure. they can be a very negative thing that ends up having a positive, you know, outcome.
I think most times, because if you're finding success like right out of the gate, you follow that path. It's not until you hit the wall that you go, oh shit, that didn't work. I got to go this way. I think that's amazing that you could take that. Because to me, I tried stand-up comedy one time. I went up, I couldn't make people laugh, and I wanted to throw up, and so I never went back on stage again.
That totally blows my mind because you have the one best man toast that I've ever quoted to people who don't know anyone at the wedding. Like those jokes were funny that I can tell them to total strangers, to the two of you, and they'll still laugh at them.
So let's just touch on it right now. I knew it was a short matter of time before it came up because of anything that's here. When I get Mac and Rick in the same area, Mac has to bring up the fact that you quote him regularly.
I don't remember it, by the way.
Yeah, so Mac, just so you know, Rick and I are going to do a revisit here soon, and like call it a 15-year anniversary of my speech at his wedding and his speech at my wedding, and revisit the whole thing. So it'll be on a podcast here before too long.
I didn't see your speech. I don't know. I wasn't there for that one, but
oh, it is classic. You want to talk about someone bombing?
Whoa! I got some laugh. You just relax.
Oh, Mac, my Christmas gift to you.
It can't all be winners. It can't all be winners.
Is that right?
And listen, here's the thing. In my defense, 10% of the audience didn't speak English. So,
oh Jesus Christ. What'd you say? Like that we're gonna get divorced or something like that in the wedding speech?
I didn't do that. I did not do that. I threw in one divorce joke. Turns out it didn't go over very well. The irony is, it was actually Rick's divorce joke. I was just repeating. That's the irony to the whole scenario.
Back to you, Mac. talk to me about the economics, because even you rented out a theater for 4 weeks. Like, how are you paying for that?
Oh yeah, I mean in that particular case, I mean, you know, we all me and my two co-producers, Sean and Jordana Williams, who are also married, that was like basically our one where we like hit up our families and friends for money, like did like a whole fundraising campaign, and then it basically we lost every cent.
Oh, shit.
That was definitely one of those where we were like, okay, we went to that. Well, you know, that's not going to be something that we can, I mean, we set up a more proper system of donors in the future when we had a, you know, proper nonprofit, company. But I don't think anybody was ever, you know, gonna, trust us with any one person was going to trust us with several thousand dollars again, after that. And for a number of years, we did like a lot of shows. There's like a lot of ways that you can get your show on stage cheaply in New York, if you know the various angles. And after that first play lost every dime, I started doing like a lot of short play festivals, just like a lot of 10-minute play festivals, which is very good for me because I had to learn how to write 10-minute plays, how to tell an interesting, complete story in 10 minutes. And that made my full-length plays so much better when I went back to them, because I had had a good lesson in making every minute count towards the forward propulsive movement of the story. And then there were one-act festivals, you know, it would be like a collection of maybe, say, 3 30-minute plays, which is another good form to master as a playwright. And then eventually started getting involved in the New York International Fringe Festival.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
By the time me and my colleagues started getting involved in doing shows for it, they had gotten prestigious enough that they were able to get into really nice venues. The first show that we did for them, which was a musical that I co-wrote with Sean and Jordana, that we actually got a really, there was the Lucille Lortel Theater on Christopher Street in the West Village. It's a really nice space. But the festival paid for the venues, but they kept most of your box office or whatever. But there were different like weird little deals you could find with a lot of downtown theaters that needed stuff on their space because they needed ticket buyers coming through the door. So, but you could sometimes get a situation where like if they kept all of the money at the door, you could do your show for a shorter run there. And so we were able to get more and more notice on prominent stages because of like little deals that we worked out.
So, Mac, give us the 1 minute version of the Honeycomb trilogy.
It's 3 plays all set in the same living room that chronicle the life of one family before, during, and after an extraterrestrial conquest of the Earth.
Nice.
In 2012, in terms of getting back to your question, Rick, about the economics, we knew that we needed a theater for 3 months to do all 3 parts of the trilogy. They're all 3 full-length plays, but it wasn't just 3 consecutive months because we needed to rehearse each play in between.
I misunderstood that. I think the Honeycomb trilogy, it's 3 different plays.
Three plays.
So you have to see the first to see the second to see the third.
Yeah. But both times we produced it, we did have some people show up who only saw 1 part. And I was like, how? And they were like, well, you know, it's a fun night. I could basically kind of pick up what had happened before.
Sure, sure.
But it definitely helps. Each play tells its own self-contained story, but the second and third play both, it helps enormously to know what happened. But in terms of the economics, we partnered up with 2 other theater companies because we needed to rent a theater for a month. Then we needed to rehearse the next play for a month. And then we needed that same theater again for a month so Sandy could put it, my wife Sandy, Eric's sister, for listeners, designed the set for it. We needed the same theater 3 times. So we teamed up with 2 other theater companies. We worked out a big kind of package deal to rent a theater for like 5+ months. We went to the theater, so we'll rent your theater for like 5 months plus some weeks. I'm not sure exactly what it was. If you'll give us like a bargain for like, you know, covering that much time for you. The other 2 theater companies, while we were rehearsing part 2 and part 3, they did their own plays in the space. And that was a way that we found to make it affordable, even though we still you always lose money on plays. Like longstanding theater companies with subscriber base and like, big Broadway hits or whatever, but plays are just a terrible investment of money.
Well, if you're saying that there's no money in the theater, you're basically doing it for the love then, right? Like this is just something you have to get out there and you love it so much.
Yeah.
But how do you get the money to go, hey, you're not going to make money here and we want to do three of them? How does that happen?
For a while, we'd sort of been hopping along with like a combination of, we all had day jobs. We were all kicking in money from our day jobs to do the shows. Plus, we did have a regular donor base, not a huge one, but we had some regulars among our audiences, relatives, whatever it was, but nothing that could do. But, you know, so we managed to cobble together enough to do the first version of the trilogy. But when we needed to come back and do, in 2012, we did the first play in January, the second play in March, and the third play in June, sequentially, because we couldn't possibly afford to do them all together. 2015, we decided, let's bring it back and let's do it in repertory so that we're doing like part one on Tuesday, part two on Wednesday, part three on Thursday. And then on Saturdays and Sundays, we would do the whole thing.
Wow.
The first play, Advanced Man, would start at 2 p.m. Second play, I can't remember, it was like 5 p.m. Then we had a dinner break. We had a deal with a local restaurant to cater a dinner break for the audience. I think the final play was at 8. So the audience would show up at 2 p.m. and then they'd be done around 10:30 p.m.
Holy cow.
So it was like a theatrical Netflix binge.
Mac, you married Sandy Yaclin. She is a lawyer who happens to be a production designer. I've never got the story of how you guys met.
Oh, okay. Well, okay. Yes. So Sandy does work as a lawyer. Done labor law. She's doing like law right now. She's doing I obviously can't name anything, but I know she works on doing a lot of doc review for big complex class action lawsuits.
It's corporate law.
I'll simplify it for the she does a lot of corporate law, and she also designs sets. The sets she designed for the Honeycomb trilogy were kind of extraordinary. They were sort of the first ones worked right out of the gate, and it got her a lot of other work doing set designs for other indie theater shows. We met, I mentioned earlier that you know, my theater company started doing shows in the New York Fringe Festival as a way of getting back on stage without having to, you know, pay the full rental price for a theater. The first year that we did the New York Fringe Festival, me and my colleagues wrote a musical called Fleet Week, which was sort of like, we wanted to do sort of like a gay version of On the Town. The sailors were coming into New York for Fleet Week. And we wrote an On the Town style musical about it. Sandy was in charge of the Lucille Ortel Theater that I mentioned that we were able to get because of the unique setup of the New York Fringe Festival. Sandy was the venue director. The New York Fringe would assign each theater where shows were being performed like its own special on-site liaison who would be able to work with like a dozen different shows to be able to handle their load-in and tech needs. Sandy was our venue director on that show.
Who made the first move?
She was the first one to like actually suggest a date.
Makes sense.
Yeah. So I guess that was the first thing that fully constituted a move. So that was definitely Sandy, no doubt. Yeah.
You guys dated for a while. You got married. You made reference to a lot of work goes into a wedding. But what I would like is your recanting of, and I don't know if it was the first Christmas you came up or what the deal was, but when you came to Michigan and you fell asleep in the car and woke up.
Yeah. And it very specifically for the story was not Christmas. My first visit was during the summer. At that time, I had this horrendous job, which I worked unspeakably long hours for, the day job. And I worked an all-nighter the night before I flew up to Michigan to meet the in-laws for the very same night. We're not married at this point. We'd only been dating, you know, about 6-7 months. This was midsummer. Anyway, we flew up to Michigan. I think we had rented a car. We drove out to White Lake, where Sandy and her parents live. and I'd been up all night, so I fell asleep in the car. And Sandy didn't want to wake me. I was sound asleep. But she hadn't seen her family in a while. She obviously wanted to go inside and see her family. But she also didn't want to wake me up. So I like to think that she cracked a window. I'm not sure. But I looking back, she left me in the car. You're not supposed to do with it, like a child or a pet or whatever. So my very first meeting with my father-in-law, where the thing where you absolutely want to make a good impression, was him coming out to the car and waking me up. I'm fast asleep, and I am drenched in sweat. It's like July. My whole body is soaking through my shirt, saliva coming out of one side of my mouth. And like my whole body's just like this sheen of sweat. I didn't realize. I woke up and I'm looking up at my father-in-law, groggily, with just like, and my whole body is just like absolutely glowing, with greasy sweat, and I couldn't form a coherent sentence because I hadn't slept in 24 hours, so that was my great first impression. Oof. And this was a big reunion of one side of Eric's family, the Berkmeyers, and so there was the Berkmeyer reunion in Frankenmuth, that weird town. It's like after I've stumbled in the house, I barely say hello to everyone. I'm wearing short shorts and a t-shirt, and I'm kind of drenched in sweat. And everyone's like, "All right, we got to get right back out into the car." I'm delirious. I'm super embarrassed because I've made the worst first impression on everybody. I'm still soaking wet. And then we drive. It's like I'm in a dream. We drive to this town that looks like it's from back in time. I wasn't sure if I was asleep or awake. I'm like looking around at Frank, and I didn't know where the hell I was. And they're like, "Yeah, this is this town. They're trying to preserve the look of a certain German era. They make great fried chicken." I was like, "Wait, this is the German town where they made, they're legendary for their fried chicken?" I was like, I really feel like I'm in a dream. They drive us to a picnic site. We eat so much food at this picnic site. I'm trying to make conversation with people. I look ridiculous. Everyone's brought so much food for this Berkmeyer. We eat so much food. And then we pack up all the food, get in the cars, and drive to a restaurant. Were you at that reunion, Eric?
I was not. I was down in Florida.
It was the weirdest day. I was not coherent for any of it. And I think the only reason that I was able to, like, get like sort of like a second chance from the family I think maybe they had liked Sandy's previous boyfriends less.
You were still an upgrade.
Eric, do you want to set this up?
So Mac, we're going to play you a clip, and I need to know what is the genesis behind it.
Gotcha.
Get up, get out, you lazy lout, get into your working clothes. Up to your knees in oil and grease with a grindstone to your nose. Get up, get out, you lazy head, get up, you lazy sinner. We need those sheets for tablecloths, it's almost time for dinner.
How is there a recording of that?
I knew you wouldn't remember that I recorded it.
Oh my God! I've known that song my whole life. I had no recollection of singing it into a mic. You recorded it, okay? You find that on the internet somewhere. Like I didn't post to YouTube. Okay, well, I mean that. My dad, when he would wake us up for school in the morning, he would sing, "Get up, get out, you lazy lout, get into your working clothes." Yeah, because we were just absolute worst kids in terms of getting out of bed. We absolutely never. So my dad would come and sing in that song full blast, and we'd be like, "No, Dad, shut up!" But once he got through the entire two verses, getting all the, "We need those sheets for tablecloths, it's almost time for dinner." By the time he got to the end of the second chorus, we were fully awake, for better or for worse.
It worked.
I had no idea. How did you happen to have me record it?
It was one of the times you were there at my parents, and I, you know, had a recording rig, as I usually do, and you agreed to do it. I was like, "I want to record that." And I set it up as my ringtone. It just turns out I never hear it because you never call me.
Wait, so if I call you, it's me singing that song?
It used to be. I don't know if it's still set.
We had to actually create a podcast that get you guys to talk. The confusion you had on your face there reminded me of the Yaklins. Every year have the greatest Christmas ever. It's like something out of a movie, you know, when all the family gets there and you guys do the white elephant. And I always, and the white elephant is, you try and get the worst gift you can, and then someone gets stuck with it. So I always try and give the worst gift. So this year, someone opened up the gift, and it was a stuffed animal or stuffed doll or whatever of Mac. We put his face on Buzz Lightyear. And the look that you had, you were so confused of like, "What? How is this possible? Who took my picture and is selling these dolls?"
I couldn't figure out why it existed. I was like looking at it, I was thinking in my head absurdly, like, what, could there be a market for this?
And the answer is yes, there's absolutely a market for that.
I got one more story, which is my favorite Mac story, that I don't know how you're going to tell it because I know how I remember it, which is when Sandy had you purchase your new TV.
I just didn't understand anything about how technology had evolved. I moved to New York City in the late 90s with the television that my parents bought me for my apartment in college. So we're talking about at this point, about a mid-90s.
CRT, super heavy, yeah, cathode ray tube, super heavy tube TV.
Look at the brain on Eric.
I had not been involved with the purchase of a new television set since probably 1995. And so, 2013, so Sandy and I, we happened to live within walking distance of a PC Richards where we lived in Astoria. And so we went on their catalog, we picked out the TV that we wanted, and Sandy sent me to the store to go purchase it. So I went into the store and I showed the model and I bought it. And I then had the most confusing conversation with the guy, the thing where I was like, I say, okay, so how do we arrange getting this to my apartment? So because bear in mind, I live about six blocks away. So I don't know if I could rent a hand truck from you, or if there's a delivery option, or if I can hire some people who work here. I was like, basically, I'm just, can you, and they're like staring, they have no idea what I'm talking about. Like, you need that much help to get a TV to your house? I was like, yeah, I live like six blocks from here. He's like, there's no way I'll ever. And like, somebody bring it. And finally, they brought it out to me, and I picked it. I was like, I had no idea what they could do with televisions now. I could pick it up myself.
Oh, is it? It's a thin TV?
Since the 90s, they had removed all the weight from television. I didn't know they could do that. I thought it was like carrying a TV like you would own in the 90s, the cathode ray, whatever. They called the way I was like, there's absolutely no way I can carry this six New York City blocks without dropping it, breaking my foot and the TV.
So the thing, Mac, you told me when you told that story initially was once he brought it out and you saw he was carrying it out and you picked it up and you went, oh, I didn't know we now live in the future.
Because I was like, oh, this is like a science fiction thing.
Just know, Mac, that anytime I think of you in the back of my head, I always say, oh, we live in the future. I think we're wrapping up. I know, Mac, you said we'd stop by 11:30.
Thank you so much for doing this.
Oh, yeah, yeah. This is super fun. Yeah, yeah. No, this is a pleasure.
Bye.
See you later, folks.
God, I'm fascinated by theater because I think 90% of theater is horrible, just awful, god awful. But when you get that 10%, there may be nothing better.
Yeah, it's cool. It's cool. I really do. I remember being really blown away by the Universal Robots. Are we done?